be able to execute it. In order to make a plan, they needed more information. Hence their current mission, looking for one of the Empress's soldiers they could question. As they closed in on the couple, Jenna could make out more of the conversation. The male wanted to mate. The female most definitely did not. Jenna caught the words princess and empress and treason. Were there princesses on the desert coast as well as empresses? The female didn't look like a princess, from Jenna's limited experience. Both parties were dressed in the garb of the Empress's soldiers, though neither had the smudgy glow she'd seen before. All at once, the male charged at the female, knocking her backward. Pinning her to the ground, he began tearing at her clothing.
"See? Mating."
"No," Jenna said. "This is not how humans mate. This is wrong." The female sent the male flying and scooped up her knife. She managed to draw blood before the male had her down again. Then he had something in his hand, something that glittered in the moonlight. Her knife.
"Kes, stop them! Hurry!"
The dragon folded his wings and plummeted earthward. Jenna knew from experience how that looked from below. They'd been flying so high they were all but invisible to human eyes, especially at night. Now they descended so fast that they would be on their prey before the male and female knew what hit them. Jenna scented blood as the dragon's claws sank into the male's back. He screeched, kicked, and flailed while Kes struggled to lift him into the air. Jenna could feel the dragon's heart pounding against her chest, feel his blazing heat beneath the scales. The female stared up at them, eyes wide, blood spattered across her face.
"Jenna!"
"Kill the male. Catch the female." With one final effort, Kes swooped off the mountain and let his cargo go. With that weight gone, they rocketed skyward. By now, the female had retrieved her sword and was making a run for it. Kes circled around and drove her back with torrents of flame. She threw her knife, dove, rolled, scrambled, then, finally, made her stand like a warrior, feet slightly apart, sword at the ready. Kes landed heavily on the ledge, a short distance away, folding his wings as best he could. He swung his head toward the female, the girl, breathing in her scent. She raised her sword in warning. Jenna slid to the ground into the shelter of Kes's wing, then stepped out from behind it so that she could get a better look at their captive. The Empress's warrior stared at Jenna as if she'd emerged from the dragon's bunghole. The girl's hair was the color of winter-seared wheat. It had been braided, but now was mostly hanging free around her battered face. She was tall, muscular, and fierce. Her curved blade was the kind carried by the Empress's blood-sworn.
"Drop the sword," Jenna said in common.
The soldier flinched, as if she hadn't expected human speech. She swiped blood from her face with her sleeve, glanced to either side as if looking for options, then finally let her sword fall to the ground at her feet. Chin up and defiant, she met Jenna's eyes. There was something familiar about her that raised goose flesh on the back of Jenna's neck. A fist of memory squeezed her heart and drove the air from her lungs.
"Wolf,"
Kes said, before Jenna could put it into words. Yes, this girl had the same wolfish aspect as the healer, Adam Wolf. While the healer had smoldered, this wolf burned hot. She was wilder, more savage.
"Cornered wolf."
And then, nudging her back into the shelter of his wing, added,
"Wolf pack."
Out of the darkness they came, silent as smoke, with their thick gray fur and brilliant, intelligent eyes. Their hot breath froze on their muzzles and ruffs, and their massive paws barely dented the earth. With her attention focused on Kes, the warrior did not seem to notice the wolves all around her.
The wolves gazed at Jenna and Cass for what seemed to be a long time, then turned as one and melted into the darkness. Jenna, awestruck, stared after them. By now, the warrior was growing restless.
"This is your meeting," she snapped in common. "What do you want?"
"Who are you?" Jenna said, the words awkward in her mouth after the ease of communicating mind to mind with Cass.
"I'm Alyssa Gray," the soldier said. "Captain."
She spoke in a clipped fashion, like a prisoner of war identifying herself.
"Who is that?"
Jenna pointed toward the canyon with her chin.
"Quill Bosley, Lieutenant. You both fight for the Empress?"
With a flicker of hesitation, Gray said,
"Yes, I am, was, his commanding officer." "Why was he attacking you, then?"
"Because he does not understand the chain of command," the wolf girl said.
"What?"
Gray rolled her eyes.
"Because he has the talent of a turd floating in an ego the size of the ocean."
Jenna laughed, which took her by surprise.
"Stop it," she thought. "This is the enemy. You must interrogate her, and then you must kill her so that she doesn't give you away."
Meanwhile, Gray had been studying Jenna with equal interest.
"So you were riding the, dragon?"
she said, as if choosing her words carefully.
"Tell her my name is Cass."
"She doesn't need to know that,"
Jenna said in their silent speech.
"Yes,"
she said aloud.
"I didn't know that the Empress had a flying army,"
Gray said, clearly fishing for information.
"How many dragons do you have?"
"Tell her people don't have dragons. Let me handle this."
Gray was looking from one of them to the other, as if she suspected that she was being left out of something.
"I am more of a scout," Jenna said. "Who are you scouting for?"
It was striking how quickly Gray turned the conversation, as if she were used to questioning prisoners, issuing orders, and having them obeyed.
"I ask the questions, you answer," Jenna said. "Isn't that how it works in an interrogation?"
"Is that what this is?"
"Where are you from?" Jenna said. "You're not from around here."
"Neither are you."
Jenna lost patience.
"Cass."
Cass straightened his neck, bringing his head to within a few feet of Gray, so that his fuming breath swirled around her. The captain skipped back a step as Jenna caught the scent of scorched wool.
"It seems very well trained,"
Gray said, then leapt back again to avoid a gout of flame.
"Trained?"
Cass's scales rattled as he bristled.
"We are partners," Jenna said. "Cass is sensitive about what you call the chain of command. Now, where are you from?"
"I'm from the wetlands," Gray said. "That's what they call it here. From the mountains in the north."
"The north?"
Jenna's heart accelerated. The healer was a wolf from the north, too.
"What are you doing here?"
"I was captured in the fall of Chalk Cliffs," Gray said. "The Empress brought me back here and drafted me into her army."
"You don't shine like the others."
Gray licked her lips. "No, I don't shine like the others."
"How many of you are there?"
"Prisoners, officers, or troops?" She spoke with precision, like a soldier.
"How many troops?"
"Tens of thousands," Gray said. "More every day."
"What does the Empress intend to do with these troops?"
Jenna said.
"What is the plan?"
Gray cocked her head, clearly puzzled that the Empress's scout was asking a soldier about the Empress's plans. "The Empress hasn't shared that with me," she said.
"If you had to take a guess," Jenna persisted, "what do you think she is planning?"
If I had to take a guess, Gray said, I would say that she plans to conquer the Seven Realms. When? Soon. Jenna pulled a scroll from her carry bag. Sit, she said, gesturing toward a flat spot on the ledge. Warily, Gray sat cross-legged. Jenna sat across from her and unrolled the scroll on the stone between them, anchoring the corners with pebbles. Cass extended his body into a semicircle around them and promptly went to sleep. He still tired easily when forced to fly for long periods or when carrying extra weight. Gray kept peering nervously at the dragon coiled around them. Jenna touched her shoulder and pointed to the map she'd drawn. It was an aerial view of Seliskard. It was all there, the wharves, the buildings, the marble stump that was the beginning of a palace, the rows of tents represented with little triangles. Gray stared down at it, then raised her eyes to Jenna. This is fine work, she said, as if surprised. Did you draw this? Yes. Truth be told, Jenna was rather proud of it.
No, don't be taking a liking to this girl. She is the enemy.
I need to know where the Empress stays, Jenna said, running her fingers over the harbor front.
Is she in the Marble Palace yet, or is she sleeping somewhere else?
Gray straightened, understanding dawning on her face. You don't work for the Empress at all, do you? Who do you work for?
I work for myself, Jenna said.
You're planning to attack the capital, Gray said, unable to hide her excitement.
I am planning to attack the Empress, Jenna said. If she is in the capital, then I will attack the capital.
Why? Gray said, leaning forward, her hands on her knees. Why are you doing this on your own?
I'm not on my own, Jenna said. I'm with Cass, and I have my reasons. Now, she said, meaning to put an end to the counter-interrogation, tell me, Captain, why do I see a wolf in you?
It was a tactic that had worked well on the healer, and it did not disappoint now. Gray folded a bit, as if she'd taken a hard punch to the gut, and her face turned the color of ashes. She took two hard breaths, clenched her fists, then looked up at Jenna. Once again, the wolf was cornered.
What do you mean? Gray said. I fly with dragons, Jenna said. You run with the wolves.
Gray was doing her best to look baffled, but it came off as slightly nauseous.
You see, I've met a wolf like you before. We met in Arden's court, but he was from the north.
Gray's head came up. What do you mean, someone like me? She said. Do you mean that he looked like me? Jenna studied her critically.
No, not really. He was a red-haired healer, a lone wolf with wounded eyes. He wore a snake pendant.
Gray came up on her knees and gripped Jenna's shoulders, her face a battleground between heartbreak and hope.
A healer? A red-haired healer?
She all but shouted, so that Cass raised his head in alarm.
What was his name?
Gray was asking questions again, but Jenna didn't care.
He had many names, Jenna said. He called himself Adam Freeman. I called him Adam Wolfe. Neither was his real name. He had strong, gentle hands, and he talked to horses.
She forced her mind back to the images that had poured in when they joined hands.
He saw his father die in a snowy street, his blood spattering the cobblestones. Ash!
It was more a primitive cry than a word.
You saw him in Auden's court? When?
Jenna's heart leapt. This fierce wolf warrior knew the healer, under yet another name. She'd be able to tell her where he came from and where he was now. She could fly to him, and they could... But no... Her excitement abated a little as she realized that couldn't happen any time soon.
Cass would have to be completely recovered before they launched an attack on the Empress, or tried to batter their way through the storm wall again.
"When did you see him?"
Gray repeated, louder than before.
"First, you tell me, what is the healer's real name, and what is the connection between you?"
For a long moment, they sat, knee to knee, and all but nose to nose, staring at each other, each holding on to her secrets and trying to decide whether to trust the other. "His real name is Adrian," Gray said finally. "And he was, or is, my brother."
Chapter 46 Party of the Year. Destin Carn leaned against the wall, nursing his drink, watching and waiting. The Madelons were working the room, chatting with each of the guests at one time or another. They exceeded Destin's rather low expectations, though he guessed that nobody survived at the Ardenine court for long without learning some knack for connivory. The captain and the corporal flirted gamely and danced awkwardly, which fit in with the role they were playing. They really needed to work on their blackbird swagger. Even Destin danced a little, choosing his targets carefully. For instance, he cut in when Granger seemed determined to monopolize the young Lady Harper all night long. He was afraid that if he didn't intervene, one of the Madelon brothers would, or the lady herself would punch Granger out. After two circuits around the dance floor, she spoke.
"You're a good dancer," she said, cheeks flaming. "That loathsome Bailiff Granger needs to learn some better manners."
"That's why I cut in, Lady Madelon," Destin said. "I was tired of watching you fend him off. What did you two talk about?"
"Mostly he talked about himself, about his horses and hounds, and how he wants to tear down Whitehall and build a bigger house, and how a marriage between us made a lot of sense."
"Did he mention that he's already engaged?" She scowled.
"That didn't come up."
"What did you say?"
"Very little."
"Good thinking," Destin said. "The other piece of advice I have for you is to keep lots of people around the two of you at all times. If anything happens that you don't like, scream bloody murder. Oh, and under no circumstances should you let him fetch you a drink, not even a cup of cider. And here."
Destin slid a dagger from one of his many hidden sheaths and handed it across.
"Hide this well. Don't use it unless you have no choice. If you have no choice, the best entry point is here."
He demonstrated the proper placement by tapping just above his own collarbone.
"Aim the blade downward and keep pushing until it won't go any farther."
She stared down at the dagger, then up at Destin.
"You're saying I should kill him?"
Clearly she thought it must be some kind of trick or trap.
"If you have to."
"I can't take this," she protested, running her fingers over the fancy work. "It looks like some kind of heirloom."
"Oh, it is," Destin said, closing her hands around the hilt. "I think it will find a good home with you."
Harper looked around for witnesses, then slid the blade into her bodice, settling it between her breasts so that the hilt was hidden, then gazed up at him, her head tilted, eyes narrowed.
"What is it?" he said.
"I appreciate your looking out for me, Lieutenant. What I don't understand is why."
Destin looked over her shoulder to where his father was hugging the other wall.
"When I was a little older than you, I failed to protect someone close to me, and I've regretted it ever since. I should have acted sooner and with more precision."
"I'm sorry for your loss," she said.
He half smiled.
"I'm a lot better at killing these days."
The song came to a close, and he bowed to her.
"It's getting close to 10 o'clock," he said. Keep your mask on, Lady Madelon.
He walked away toward the punch bowl, feeling the pressure of her gaze on his back. By twos and threes, the others followed, some lost in conversation and seeming to wander closer by accident, others apparently there to quench a sudden thirst. Several young children raced to that end of the room, their mothers chasing after. Granger returned to his quarry as soon as Destin left her side. But then the elder Lady Madelon intervened, giving him a sound scolding and sending him on his way with a thunderous look on his face. "If tonight's operation isn't successful, I suppose I'll have to kill him," Destin thought. "Maybe, even if it is." Hal flinched when the clock in the Temple Tower finally struck 10. The sound was still reverberating through the ballroom when the entire building shuddered. It sounded like an explosion coming from the direction of the temple, then another from the barracks, then a blast from the direction of the armory. Moments later, another thunderous explosion, which must have been the munitions going up. "All hell will break loose," Lieutenant Karn had said. Another promise kept. The party guests screamed and milled about, covering their ears, unsure which way to run. General Karn bolted from the hall, probably heading for the garrison house. The king's guard and soldiers came to life, herding the king and his downrealm guests through a doorway and out of the ballroom toward the central bailey, the most robust fortification in the palace. All except...
"Mother!"
King Jarrett cried, turning back and scanning the room.
"Where's Queen Marina? Where's Princess Madeline?"
"Your Majesty, please come quickly,"
one of the blackbirds said, hustling Jarrett toward the door.
"No doubt the Queen and your sister are already in the bailey."
Jarrett hesitated, still searching the ballroom with his eyes, until a brace of guards half carried him through the doorway. Hal was so distracted by all of this that he nearly drew his sword when Destin Karn gripped his arm.
"Go," Karn said. "Get them out now. I can't be seen with you."
Hal and Robert herded the bewildered families back behind the fountain, through the draperies and into the hidden pantry. When all were through, they crowded elbow to nose in the serving area. Robert stationed himself just inside the exit door to hand out cloaks. Hal pulled on his own cloak and slipped out into the courtyard to see if the area was clear. It was still raining and harder now, which was a good excuse for them all to be wearing cloaks, plus likely to discourage gawkers from being out in the streets. Did Karn arrange for that too? Hal wondered. Now he could see that the temple was on fire, the armory was burning, and smoke was billowing up from the barracks. Civilians were running past him away from the armory, while blackbirds and soldiers were running toward it. This meant that nobody was looking in on the ballroom or noticing people emerging from the servants' entrance. Hal poked his head back into the pantry.
"It's clear," he said. "Send them out, and when I have half of them, I'll take them to Newgate. You bring the other half. Pretend you're running to safety."
Hal waited by the door, and as the families poured through, like a cloud of black wraiths in their cloaks, he instructed them to take their masks off and hide them underneath. One of them didn't bother to remove her mask, but flung her arms around Hal and buried her face in his shoulder.
"Harper, everyone said you were dead," she whispered, her voice thick with tears. Hal patted her back, his own cheeks suspiciously wet. But maybe that was just the rain.
"Not yet," he said.
When he'd counted 25, he called in to Robert.
"I have 25, including Mother and Harper, which means you should have 22, including babies and children. Count them carefully, and when you have everyone, follow me to Newgate."
Hal set out for Karn's private prison with his charges. He found that it was more like a cat-herding expedition than a forced march. The children broke away and stomped through puddles. They threw their heads back, catching raindrops on their tongues. Mothers and older sisters chased them down, edging them back onto the proper path. As he watched, Harper scooped up a four-year, parking him on her hip and walking him back to the others. They haven't been outside for 3 months, Hal thought, his anger rising. Harper's been looking out for these little ones all this time. When they passed the postern gate, it was clotted with blackbirds armed to the teeth, questioning and searching everyone who passed through. The explosions had been a good distraction, drawing soldiers and guards away, but now getting out was going to be a problem. When they reached Newgate, Lila Barrowhill was there at the gate, directing them into the small courtyard just inside. As they passed through, Hal counted, and then he counted Robert's lot when they arrived. They seemed to have one extra person. Someone tapped him on the shoulder. He swung around and saw that it was Queen Marina and her daughter, the Princess Madeline, cloaked up like the others.
"Young Madelon," she said, "I thought that was you. I'm so glad to see that rumors of your death were exaggerated."
"Your Majesty," Hal said, totally ambushed. "I didn't... What are you doing here?"
"I planned this party, remember?" the Queen said. "Jarrett is more like his father every day, looking for someone to blame for his failures. I'd rather he blame me for the hostage's escape than Destin, and I really need to get Madeline away from Arden's court before her brother matches her with some monster."
But now that the Queen and her daughter had joined them, there should be 49 in all. There were only 48. Following them through the gate, he counted again. Someone was missing. His mother grabbed his arm, her face pale and strained.
"Have you seen Harper? She was with us, and I don't know what happened to her. Do you think she wandered off?"
They both knew better. Harper had too much common sense to wander off. Not now.
"I'll look for her," Hal said, turning back toward the gate,
to find someone standing in the gap. Two someones. It was Luke Granger, with a knife to Harper's throat. Chapter 47 Double Cross.
"Well, now," Granger said, "how does it happen that, in the confusion after the explosions, the families of the rebellious Thanes end up here, at the entrance to Lieutenant Carn's private prison? Before you passed through the gate, I was able to intercept young Lady Matalon. When I attempted to question her, the little minx pulled a knife on me." He scanned the crowd. "Now, where is Lieutenant Carn? He has some explaining to do."
Harper had her narrow-eyed, scheming face on.
"Please, Harper," Hal thought, "don't make any sudden moves." "She's just a child," his mother said. "You cannot blame her for trying to defend herself when she is attacked in the streets."
"Where she shouldn't have been in the first place," Granger said. "An attack on a member of the nobility is a serious offense. It's a shame, because I'd hoped that... well, so very disappointing."
His smug expression belied his words.
"Let her go, Granger," Queen Marina said, taking a step toward them.
"Your Majesty," Granger said, "and little Princess Madeline. Curiouser and curiouser."
He didn't look curious, though. He looked delighted.
"My lord," Hal said, "I think you are misunderstanding what you see. My corporal directed us to escort these women and children here to Newgate, where they could be safely held until we have identified and neutralized the threat."
The tactical language, at least, came easily to Hal.
"Is that your story?"
Granger's confidence dwindled a bit, but only just.
"Well, we'll see. Guillaume should be back at any moment with the King's guard."
"In the meantime, Lord Granger, why not allow them to go inside, out of the rain?" Hal said. "If any of them fall ill, my corporal will have my ass."
Granger licked his lips.
"Everybody stays here,"
he said, until we sort this out.
He looked around again.
Where the hell is Karn?
Ow! Hopper cried. You cut me!
It all happened in a split second. The startled Granger dropped his blade hand away enough that Harper was able to twist in his one-armed grip, seize his hand with both of hers, and plunge the blade into his neck, leaning in so it penetrated all the way to the hilt. Robert, who'd been edging closer the entire time, barreled into Granger, knocking the Thaneling onto his back on the cobblestones, where he lay, both hands scrabbling at the knife, blood bubbling from his mouth. Hal leapt to help his brother, but there was no need. Granger was gone.
Now he looks disappointed, Robert growled. The greedy, gutter-swiving, ass-licking...
Language, Robert, Lady Madelon said.
She stood over them, one arm around Harper, who was pale as parchment, shaking so that her teeth rattled together.
Are you all right, Harper?
Hal sat back on his heels, looking up at her. Did he cut you?
I'm fine.
Harper's voice trembled, just a little. When several of the Litlings began to cry, she forced a smile and said,
Don't worry. The bad man won't hurt us.
They shouldn't be here, Hal thought. Children should never have to witness a scene like this.
Speaking of surviving the night, we've got to go.
It was Karn's friend, Lila.
Everyone, into the building, now, before the bad man's friends show up.
Hal and Robert exchanged glances. It seemed very strange to be rushing back into prison when they had gone to so much trouble to get out. Was this just some kind of new trap or power play by Destin Karn, who'd been notably absent since the explosion? Was he trying to gain custody of the hostages for his own murky purposes? They had no choice, really. Leaving Granger lying in the street, they entered the prison, crossing the threshold into which was carved, The Truth Shall Make You Free. They descended several staircases, each level danker, the air thicker and more oppressive. Harper gripped Hal's arm, leaned close, and murmured,
Don't tell me we're going back to the pit.
We'd better not be, Hal said, with a dark look at Lila.
Eventually, they seemed to hit bottom, and then struck out horizontally into what now seemed to be a natural cave, only lightly shaped by the hand of man. At one turning, Lila pulled a large crate from an alcove in the wall, unlocked it, and handed a dozen torches to those in the lead. They were flashcraft and began to glow as soon as they were lifted from the crate. Some of the Litlings began to fuss. Their mothers pressed on grimly, carrying their children if necessary. Hal and Robert ended up carrying two of Lady Harrisford's four children. Hal had long since accepted the fact that they were so far in, there was no going back. With the distance they'd traveled, at least it was unlikely they were still anywhere near Citadel Hill. Finally, the tunnel sloped upward, in some places growing so steep that steps had been carved into the cave floor. The air freshened and became noticeably cooler and drier. Finally, Queen Marina came up beside Hal.
Lady Delacroix really cannot go much farther, and your mother is struggling too. If we collapse, then it's going to slow us down considerably. We need to say something. If we still have miles to go, we're going to need to stop for a rest.
Hal nodded, though at this point he wasn't exactly sure who was in charge of this enterprise, he or Barrow Hill or the Queen. He was threading his way forward toward Lila when he noticed that the oppressive darkness was thinning, the walls to either side becoming visible, even beyond the reach of the torchlight. They were obviously nearing an opening to the outside. It wasn't bright. Likely the sun hadn't yet risen. As the others began to notice, some of them put on speed, children tugging at their mother's hands, stumbling over rocks in their eagerness for the long, scary journey through the dark to end. Up ahead, Lila stopped, turned, and waited for them to catch up. When the entire group was gathered, Lila said, "This is where we surface. We should be outside the city, beyond whatever perimeter the King's Guard has put up. I need everyone to wait here while I check and make sure our transportation is ready to go."
"I'm thirsty," a little boy whined.
"Don't worry," Lila said, ruffling the boy's hair. "They'll have food and drink for you." She disappeared through the cave entrance. She wasn't gone long, but by the time she returned, some of the litlings had curled up on the floor or on their mother's laps and gone fast asleep. "All right," Lila said. "The wagons are just outside. Each one holds about 10 people. There's room for everyone. I want families to stay together and board the same wagon. We need to be well on our way before the sun comes up." As the families began trickling toward the door, Hal took hold of Lila's elbow.
"Well on our way where? Where are we going?"
Lila cocked her head. "Didn't you talk to Lieutenant Karn about that?"
"He's been tight-lipped," Hal said. "He's told us just enough to get this far."
Lila shrugged. "You'll have to ask him. I'm just the hired help." She rubbed her thumb and fingers together, signifying payment. Hal's temper was fraying.
"I would like to ask him, but I haven't seen him since the blasts went off."
He followed Lila out of the cave to find himself in a pitch-dark copse of trees at the bottom of a ravine. He could hear water running somewhere nearby and the soft nickering of horses. Where were they? It was hard to judge how far they'd traveled in the dark. Lila pointed them down the ravine to where it opened up into an abandoned farmyard. The house had long since been burned. The barn and outbuildings were still standing, though, and 4 wagons were lined up, each with a team of 4 sturdy mountain ponies. The wagons were enclosed, so as to keep passengers out of the weather and out of sight of prying eyes. They resembled the wagons used by clan traders to transport their goods, something rarely seen in the Empire these days. The first family was climbing into the first wagon. The driver was muffled in a scarf and coat that seemed too heavy for the weather. He'd placed a step next to the wagon to make it easier to climb in. As each one passed, he handed him or her a wrapped bundle and a deerskin flask, the promised water. As each wagon filled, it pulled away, rolling down the farm lane and disappearing into the trees.
"This doesn't look familiar," Hal said, touching Robert's arm. "Do you know where we are?"
Robert shrugged.
"We should be on our way to Temple Church to join Father and the others, so I'm guessing we're somewhere north of the city."
"Maybe," Hal said,
"but I've been up and down the north road between Ardenscourt and Delphi way too many times. I don't remember seeing a stretch this remote."
He squinted up at the sky, but between the sodden clouds and the canopy of trees, he couldn't get a fix on their location. The rain seemed to muffle sounds, the mist lending an air of risk and mystery.
"Well," Robert said, "we wouldn't want to come up too close to the road, would we? It's probably just that..."
Hal put his hand up.
"Hang on. Isn't that the last of the wagons?"
Robert stared as the wagon rounded the curve and disappeared.
"Hey!"
he said, running a few steps after it until he must have realized it was no use. Hal turned to find Barrowhill striding toward them.
"That's the last of them," she said. "The Queen and the Princess are with them. Let's hope they don't run into any trouble along the way."
"We were supposed to go with them," Hal said. "Isn't that what we agreed on?"
"My agreement is with Lieutenant Karn," Barrowhill said, brow furrowed. "I thought he'd have filled you in."
"No," Hal said through gritted teeth. "He did not fill us in."
"You mean you got into this without really knowing the plan?"
Barrowhill shook her head.
"That's never a good idea."
Automatically, Hal thrust out an arm to prevent Robert from leaping forward and throttling her.
"What is the plan?" he said.
"Well," Barrow Hill looked from Hal to Robert, "it's not really my place to... Look, here he is now."
Destin Carn materialized from among the trees like a black-clad wraith. Chapter 48 Double Double Cross. In his blackbird cloak, Carn looked sharp and deadly as an obsidian blade. Hal was feeling fairly deadly himself.
"I met the wagons on the road, so I'm glad to see that our guests are on their way," the spymaster said. "A good night's work, and the only casualty was poor Granger. I was so impressed by young Lady Harper. If she ever expresses an interest in..."
"Where have you been?" Hal demanded. "Where are my mother and sister and the rest of the families? Robert and I were supposed to escort them to White Oaks."
"They're not going directly to White Oaks," Carn said. "But don't worry. They will be safe and comfortable, and out of the king's hands. That will free everyone to negotiate in good faith."
"If you meant to double-cross us, why not just leave us to rot in Newgate?"
Robert said, his hand on the hilt of his sword. At that particular moment, mage or no mage, Hal was ready to draw his own sword and make the spymaster bleed, to the breaker with the consequences.
"How have I double-crossed you?" Carn said with a puzzled frown. "We had a common goal— to take the hostages out of the hands of Gerrit Montaigne, and we have done that. No doubt he'll be more amenable to striking a deal with the Thanes, with his bargaining power diminished. It seems to me that your goal was to take the hostages out of the king's hands and take custody of them yourself," Hal said. "For what purpose, I don't know, but I intend to find out."
"That's easy enough," Carn said. "I'll tell you. But first, let me ask you a question. What is likely to happen if the hostage families are returned to the Thanes?"
"We'll all live happily ever after," Hal thought. "I can take an army north."
"Will your father and his allies be more likely to come to the table?"
Carn persisted. Hal wanted to say yes, but he knew in his bones that wasn't true. He shook his head.
"Freed of worry about the hostages, the Thanes will march on Arden's court and depose the king sooner rather than later. Won't that be nice? Maybe your father will be crowned king. King Arshel," Carn said as if savoring the phrase. "You and Robert can be princes, though Matalon had better watch his back. I happen to know that the Delacroix family is moving behind the scenes to make sure that it's King Pascal. In fact, an attack on the capital could be the starting point for a new civil war. Meanwhile, the Empress is marching. As things stand, I suspect whoever wins will have a very short reign."
Hal thought of the harbor at Chalk Cliffs, full of the Empress's ships, of the beaches teeming with horse soldiers, and he had to agree.
"I know your father has a policy against giving in to the demands of hostage-takers," Carn said. "He won't accept an unsatisfactory deal on account of them. And Gerrit would never offer a reasonable deal as long as he held the hostages. It will be my job to convince Gerrit to offer terms that the Thanes can accept. The fact that his mother and sister are with the hostages might help that case. It will be your job to persuade the Thanes to sign on."
"I'm a soldier," Hal protested, "not a diplomat."
"Who better to convince an old warrior like your father?" Carn said.
"That's not going to happen," Hal said. "It doesn't matter who's holding the hostages. It just means that he'll be even more determined to hold you accountable."
"Perhaps some of the other Thanes will be more receptive," Carn said. "To be honest, I am not close to the young king. As spymaster for the kingdom, It would be my fault that the hostages escaped. By the time Jarrett realizes that he needs me, or at least someone smarter than Granger, I'll have taken my bow on Executioner's Hill.
Do you really think so? Hal said skeptically. Surely General Karn would intervene to...
Karn laughed. You have been away from court a while, haven't you? My father will do everything in his power to pin it on me. If he intervenes, it will be to put the noose around my neck.
If the Thanes take the city before then...
Then they will be fighting each other for the honor of executing me, Karn said. You see, no matter what happens, I will need leverage to protect myself and those who are important to me.
Hal was mystified. Who was the spymaster trying to protect, other than himself?
If what you're saying is true, the Thanes are smelling blood in the water, Hal said. Even if King Jarrett offers improved terms, they will not be in the mood for negotiation.
I realize that this is a desperate plan, but such are the kind made by desperate men. I will do everything in my power to prevent the Empress from claiming the West as well as the East.
Hal and Robert exchanged glances. Hal had his own reasons for wanting to march against the Empress, but what drove Karn? He seemed the type that would land on his feet no matter what. It brought to Hal's mind his own conversation with Lissa Gray, when he assured her that her life wouldn't change much under Arden's rule. This spymaster has secrets too, he thought. Hal needed to buy time, to consider what move to make next.
All right, he said, as if giving in. The Thanes will want to know who's holding our families now. What am I supposed to tell them?
Karn frowned, thinking.
The Queen in the North?
Barrowhill suggested, leaning against a tree and using the blade of a dagger to strip dirt from under her nails.
If I tell them it's the Queen in the North, I know exactly what will happen, Hal said. My Lord Father already thinks I've been bewitched by the Wolf Queen. If I told him I helped put our families into the enemy's hands, he would know it for sure. He'd clap me in irons and send in the priests.
Oh, Barrowhill said, looking up from her work. Damn, that's too bad.
Something in the way she said it caused them all to turn and look at her.
What do you mean? Karn said.
I mean that I'm serious, Barrowhill said. They are on their way to the Queen in the North.
You sent Harper and Mother to the Witch in the North?
Robert practically shouted. Hal put his hand on his brother's arm and shook his head. Karn's hand crept to his amulet.
Explain yourself, he said in a flat, deadly voice.
There's this other part of the plan that I didn't go over yet, the smuggler said. While the Thanes and your spoiled boy king dither over who gets what manor house and title, the Empress is on the march. I need things to move a little faster.
Go on, Karn said, a muscle working in his jaw.
You see, I have family in every port on the east coast, said Barrowhill. The Empress has already taken Chalk Cliffs, and Spirit Gate will be under attack before long. If you think she'll stay north of the border, I have some genuine clan-made goods to sell you. My family depends on the sea for a living.
So, Karn said, you betrayed us, and probably collected a pretty price from the Queen for doing it.
Betrayed is such a negative word, Barrowhill said. I think we're all agreed on the final goal. I just want to move things along a little faster.
I see, Karn said. And what's this final goal? Barrowhill makes a fortune? I don't remember signing on to that.
Barrowhill shook her head, looking a little hurt.
We all want to send the Empress Celestine back east. That's what we agree on. When word reaches King Jarrett that Spirit Gate is under attack, he'll wake up to the danger.
But if the Thanes have their way, he'll be dead by then.
Karn took a step toward her.
Tell me where they are, or you'll wish you had.
Barrowhill's dagger came up so quickly that he took a step back again.
You haven't even heard my plan yet, Barrowhill said.
I promise, it's a good one.
Kill me, and you'll never hear it.
Anyway, they've already set sail by now.
Southgate, then, Karn said, with a brisk nod. That's the only port close enough. It might be that we can...
Hal began to laugh, which seemed totally wrong, but once he started, he couldn't stop. They all looked at him as if he'd gone mad.
Forgive me, he said, swiping at his eyes. It's just so refreshing to see Lieutenant Karn swigging the same bitter medicine he dishes out.
Captain Matalon, Barrowhill said, I know you have no reason to trust me, and many reasons not to, but I hope you'll believe me when I say that the families will be perfectly safe, from the Northerners anyway. I've heard from my sources that you've been a guest in the North. Were you well treated?
Yes, Hal said, cautiously wondering why a smuggler would know that.
And you also had some experience with the Empress? You were in Chalk Cliffs when it was attacked.
Yes.
As soon as you came home, you tried to convince your father to let you take an army north to aid them against the Empress.
Who told you that?
Barrowhill pulled out an apple and took a bite.
I talked to everyone, she said, chewing. I have a plan that will give you an army sooner rather than later, but you might not like some parts of it.
I cannot wait to hear it,
Karn said, rolling his eyes. Barrowhill went down on one knee, spreading her arms wide.
Matalon, she said, how would you like to be king?
Chapter 49 Ties That Bind. Leaving his mother under the care of Ty Griffin and Margaret Gray, Ash met with Sasha Talbot and Captain Byrne in the sitting room of the Queen's chambers. Talbot was visibly nervous, but determined and seemingly well prepared.
"Hear me out," she said. "As you know, Captain Byrne, I've been researching queens and their bound captains in the Temple Library. I've asked you some questions, too. From what I've seen and read and heard, having a bound captain now would make Liz safer, and I'm for anything that would do that."
She stopped, as if waiting for questions or arguments, but Byrne only nodded.
"Go on," he said.
Once started, it turned into a landslide of words.
"I may be getting above myself, but I've spent the last 3 years of my life by Lys's side, and I don't think there's anyone more devoted to her. I know her as well as anyone, and if I could trade my life for hers right now, I would do it. I know the captain of the Grey Wolves has always been a Byrne, at least for 1,000 years, and you might think I shouldn't be angling for the job, but I have to speak my mind. Simon's gone, and I'm here. Long story short, I'm asking to be named Princess Alyssa's bound captain. Now rather than later."
She stood there then, her fist on her heart, back straight, jaw clenched, as if waiting to be turned down. Byrne didn't turn her down. He'd gazed at her, his eyes narrowed, rubbing his chin. Then he glanced at Ash and simply said,
"Let's talk about it in private, Corporal Talbot. I want you to know what you'd be signing on for."
They must have come to an understanding, because just 2 days later, Ash was called to participate in a binding ceremony. The ceremony took place in the small temple within the Queen's rooftop garden, accessible by secret stairs from the Queen's bedchamber, and by others from the family wing of the palace. When moonlight flooded through the glass, the handful of celebrants cast long shadows on the stone floor. But Hanalea breathed, as the saying went. The wind from the spirit mountains rattled the walls and drove shards of cloud across the night sky, obscuring and then revealing the eagle moon. Ash wore his father's robes, the Waterlow ravens over top. Sasha Talbot was barefoot, dressed in a loose, rough-spun dedicate's robe. She shifted from foot to foot, as if eager to see it done and over with. The naval commander, Hadley de Villieu, wore a dress, something Ash had seen her do maybe once or twice in his life. It was the first time Queen Rhaesa had left her rooms since the day she was poisoned. Margaret Grey and Titus Griffin had carried her in on a litter and set her down in a chair. She was wrapped in upland furs, covered in clan-made blankets, her pale face wearing a fierce expression that said, "Still a wolf." Participants could be distinguished from witnesses by their degree of nervousness. Hadley was as fearless as anyone Ash knew, but she stood, hands clenched, mumbling words under her breath, practicing. Speaker Jemson and Captain Byrne stood to either side of a small table bearing the regalia, which included a stone basin, a knife, a crystal bottle, and a silver goblet. Ash shivered. Lately, it seemed that his life was one blood ritual after another.
"Welcome," Speaker Jemson said, hauling Ash back to the present. "I apologize for the hour, but it was important that we do this without alerting any enemies of the line. Tonight, we will celebrate not one, but two milestones. Hopefully, that will make it worth disturbing your sleep."
He paused, but nobody laughed, so he went on.
"We will begin with the binding ritual, a ceremony that is at least 1,000 years old. It has occurred on a battlefield, at a roadside inn, inside a prison, and aboard ship. Believe it or not, this is the largest group ever assembled for the purpose. The essentials are a willing soldier, the blood of the line, soil from the mountain home, and a speaker of the old church. Up to now, the ceremony has been held in secret, even from the royal family, and the willing soldier has always been a Byrne."
Talbot licked her lips, as if worried that she might be declared unworthy at the last minute. Jemson smiled at her.
"But times change. Secrets are revealed, and traditions deserve examination. Perilous times require a certain flexibility of practice and an agility of mind and spirit. We began descending this slippery slope, as some would say, with Captain Eamon Byrne, who was bound to the Princess Heir Rhaesa Anna Mariana before she was crowned queen, and before his father, Eden Byrne, had passed away. This was done because then Princess Rhaesa was in danger. We continued this practice with Princess Hanalea when Simon Byrne was bound to her."
Jemson looked to Captain Byrne, who said,
"Now Hannah is dead, and Simon is dead. The line is in grave danger, and there is a need for a new guardian. This time, it seems that the best candidate to perform this service to the line is not a Byrne, but Corporal Sasha Talbot."
Talbot's cheeks pinked up, but she kept her eyes on the floor.
"We have brought you all together to serve as witnesses. Going forward, you will hold the memory of what we do here, and be ready to testify to it if need be."
He looked around the circle.
"Are you willing to be the memory of the realm?"
"We are,"
the chorus came back.
"Corporal Talbot," Jemson said, "are you willing to be bound forever to the line of Grey Wolf Queens that began with Hanalea?"
"Yes, sir,"
Talbot said, bringing her fist to her heart.
"Bear your arm, Corporal,"
Jemison said, picking up the knife. Talbot did, scraping back her sleeve. Jemison ran the tip of the blade down her forearm.